Have you seen the movie The Beach? Anyone seen that? There's a young idealistic traveller named Richard who is travelling in Thailand. He's played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And he hears rumour of a perfect life on in an unspoilt world. And he somehow finds his way with his friends to a remote, beautiful island where an international community of like-minded young travellers have escaped the world to create their own paradise on the beach. It is indeed a fantastic place, even better than Galston, a different world to the hustle and bustle and grime of Bangkok. For a while, Richard finds that life there is indeed idyllic. It seems too good to be true. And of course, it is too good to be true. These young travellers have escaped the world, but they've not escaped themselves. He discovers rivalry, manipulation, and hatred, not only among the others in the community, but in his own heart as well. Combine this with tragedy, not to mention the arrival of men with guns, and paradise becomes a horrible, insane nightmare. There's no point us discovering the world we all want if we remain the people who belonged to the world we now know. And this is a hard lesson to learn, and that's why the Old Testament is such a long book. You'll remember the basic storyline of the opening chapters from previous weeks, I'm sure. The basic storyline is that we bring disaster upon ourselves and upon the planet through rejecting God. But God promises a new world in which he will bring about through fulfilling promises given to one man back in Genesis chapter 12, the man Abraham. We now attempt to fill in that long stretch between the opening chapters of the Bible and the point when it's ready for the coming of Jesus Christ. Unfortunately, that summary we've just read avoids the need for us to read the other 800 chapters, or pages even. But essentially, the story of the Old Testament reveals how God goes about keeping his promise to Abraham, often in spite of the people themselves. He gives his people a promised land. They prove unable time and time again to create the world they all want in it. But he promises to create that world for them and, what's more, make them people they need to be qualified to live in it. So that's the three things we're saying tonight. Firstly, God gives his people the world we all want. Now this is the first half of Nehemiah's summary here. If you like to think of old movies, think of Cecil B. DeMille, Charlton Heston, The Ten Commandments, that sort of thing. If you're a little bit more up to date and watch cartoons, think of Steven Spielberg, Prince of Egypt. But the family of Abraham, it seems, do indeed become a great nation. But they also become slaves in Egypt in the book of at the end of the book of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. Through Moses, God brings them out of Egypt with the plagues mentioned there in verse 9. And he parts the Red Sea as they travel towards the Promised Land. That event in the Bible is called the Exodus. And that literally means the exit, the coming out of the people. The Bible then recounts the trials and tribulations, the successes of God, and the failures of the Israelites on their way to the Promised Land as they travel in the desert. The centerpiece of this journey was to establish with the fledgling nation a covenant. That means a new deal, or a new national contract, or constitution, I suppose we could say. Verses 13 to 14 describe that. You came down on Mount Sinai. You spoke to them from heaven. You gave them regulations and laws that are just and right, and decrees and commands that are good. You made known to them your holy Sabbath, and gave them commands, decrees, and laws through your servant Moses. Now we like to think of constitutions as being laws to protect our own individual rights, don't we? But this was more a case of laws to establish human responsibilities. But God's law, in particular, the Ten Commandments, which were at the centre of it, was a blessing, a protection, and a freedom, ultimately. So we think, for example, as we read here, oh, the Sabbath in verse 14. We think, oh, the Sabbath, that means no fun, doesn't it? No working or shopping on Sundays. How oppressive, how boring, how tedious and restrictive to have a constraint like that imposed upon our freedom. But I tell you what, if you've just spent 20 plus years as a slave, toiling every hour under the sun, working from early childhood till your premature death, well, I can assure you that if someone comes along and passes a law that says that nobody can make you work on one particular day of the week, you don't complain, do you? That is a freedom, not a restriction. The Sabbath was not a burden, it was a weekly reminder, in fact, of the world we all want, where we're not burdened by toil, a world of freedom and liberation. God didn't just give people a pleasant country to live in then. He also gave them the means to make it the world that everyone wanted. Israel, in God's plan, would become a fantastic place. That was his intention for them. Such a beacon of light that all the other nations would marvel at it and be attracted to it and visit it on holiday and copy down the laws into their own little pocketbook. And take them home and copy those laws there because they made life such a wonderful place. If the Israelites kept the law. And there, of course, is the flaw in the plan. Did anyone spot it? Except, of course, it's not really a flaw in God's plan. He knew exactly what his people were like and how they were going to turn out. The point really was to demonstrate to them, and through their example, to get it onto our thick skulls too. However kind God is, whatever material and moral and spiritual resources he gives to us, we cannot create the world we all want. That's the point of that long stretch of history. Have you ever tried to help someone with a deep-seated problem, an addiction? Say, for example, alcoholism, to pick an example. You've played your part in helping to scrape them off the floor. You've listened to them. You've encouraged them, cajoled them, admonished them, supported them. You've borne patiently with them, helped them back on their feet. And you're just starting to think that they're getting there. And then comes that late-night phone call from A&E, or the police station, or wherever, and it's right back to square one. Sometimes there even comes a point when you know that there is nothing more you can do to help this person. When, in fact, your help is just making it worse, extending the agony. And the only possible way that they might ever be free is to actually get on with it, and hit very bottom, and hope that, at last, will change them from within. Or something rather like that has happened with the people of Israel, you see. The history of God and his people in the Old Testament is rather like that. It goes round and round a cycle of blessing and failure, disaster and restoration. Nehemiah describes this cycle as the people travelled to the promised land in verses 16 to 21. And then as they are established there, they go round and round that circle. Verse 28 sort of summarises it. But as soon as they were at rest, they again did what was evil in your sight. Then you abandoned them to the hand of their enemies so that they ruled over them. And when they cried out to you again, you heard from heaven, and in your compassion you delivered them from time to time. So you see, in the story of Israel, this circle is going round and round. God gives to them the kings, like David and Solomon, to govern and rule. But then the kings go wrong. He gives to them prophets to speak to them. That's men like Isaiah and Jeremiah. But the people don't listen to them. And instead of being a beacon of light that shows God to the other nations, we find the Israelites instead adopting the gods of the other nations and starting to serve them, becoming slaves all over again. Round and round the circle they go, lower and lower, until ultimately there comes the real crunch. God's patience runs out, and the people lose their land altogether and are sent off into exile. And then even once they come back from exile, they're still the subjects of a foreign king. Now that brings us up to verses 36 and 37 of what Nehemiah has written. But see, we are slaves today, slaves in the land you gave our forefathers, so that they could eat its fruit and the other good things it produces. Because of our sins, its abundant harvest goes to the kings you've placed over us. They rule over our bodies and our cattle as they please. We are in great distress. And the book of Nehemiah is written at a time sort of in the 4th century or so BC, when it looks like God is perhaps showing his kindness again to his wayward people. There are signs the nation is being restored. They make this binding agreement to return to God. And alas, if we were to look at the rest of history, we'd find there was still a long way to go before it were ever true that they were changed as people. And ultimately, God's help for them has to come in a totally different way. But it's important to realize that the people of Israel in the Old Testament were not a bunch of basket cases compared to us. They were not spiritual alcoholics compared to the rest of us who are all right, really. No. The people of Israel were neither better nor worse than any of us. The Israelites, later called the Jews, are neither better nor worse. They are simply examples of what we are all like. And their history is there to teach us just that. We cannot make the world we all want. Whatever utopia we aspire to create. The beach may have been fiction, but in plenty of times and places, people have sought idealistically to do the same thing and discovered for a while this ideal community, only to find that they've brought all the world's infections in with them. Think about that in a grand scale in history. Think of the massive social experiments and revolutions of the last century. Communism in the East. National Socialism in Germany. That's the Nazis. They embodied monstrous ideas within them. And the idealism within them quickly gave way to corruption, barbarism, and tyranny. Or if you don't want to think big, think small. Think really small. Think the little individual paradises that so many of us try to build. That good income, the cozy family, the bourgeois lifestyle, the ideal home undergoing constant makeovers. We succeed for a while, yet at best it's a temporary bubble of personal security. And half the time it's our own flaws that bring in the harsh realities of the world. That bubble always pops, doesn't it? The Old Testament shows us that even if God personally sets us up, if he gives us the resources and the guidance we need, and then if he then cuts us plenty of slack to learn from mistakes along the way, we still can't do it. And 1,500 years plus of Old Testament history is there to prove it. He gives his people a promised land. They fail to make it into the world they wanted. But then he steps in and he promises to make them into people who are fit for it. Let's read just one passage as an example of something that we find in many places. This here is written by a prophet called Ezekiel. So you need to turn on in the Bible a few chapters. Ezekiel is a prophet, a man inspired to be a messenger of God. And he's writing from around about the time that Israel was being taken off into exile in Babylon. That's where he is at the time. So this is the point where his readers must have thought that they've really blown it now. Surely God's patience must have run out. But listen to this. The book of Ezekiel, chapter 36, but page 867, verse 24. Listen to this promise from God. For I will take you out of the nations, he says. I will gather you from all the countries and bring you back into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from your impurities and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. You will live in the land I gave your forefathers. You will be my people and I will be your God. That's his promise to them, you see. Look what God says he's going to do. He's going to restore them from to their land from exile and make it even better than before. If we were to read on, it would become the world they wanted. Well, on the way to being so. But the really important thing to notice is this. Not merely that they'll be rescued from their enemies and from their captivity, they're going to be rescued from themselves. God promises to deal with the problem of the inner spiritual rebellion that besets us all along. The problem of the sinful heart, which otherwise we were taking with us to any utopia that we might find and ruin. He promises to do this for his people something utterly unique, something radically different compared to anything that he's ever done before. Now this is especially important to take on for all kinds of reasons, but in particular, we take this on board in a world where there are many different religious options in front of us. With the fact of social pluralism and toleration, the fact that we meet many different religions in the high street, which to my mind isn't a bad thing, there also comes a philosophy of relativism. That's the thought that surely all these different roads that people take must lead to the same God. Who is to say that one religion is right and another religion is wrong, after all? How can Christianity claim to be any different or any better? Isn't that an insulting, arrogant, outrageous thing to say? Surely you have thought those things yourself or encountered that thought. Well, I don't proclaim to explain all those issues that that raises, except to explain why it is that we claim that other religions can't lead to the world we all want. For whatever truths and wisdom they may contain, undoubtedly, however noble and exemplary and admirable as people the believers of other religions undoubtedly are, religion is fundamentally an attempt to attempt to make oneself right before God, to reach one's own way up to heaven, to make the world we all want here or in the future and become the sort of person who is fit for it, whether you call that heaven or paradise or nirvana or whatever. That's what religion is, a ladder to heaven one way or another. And if the Bible is true, then you can't do it. You can't build the ladder, and even if you could, you couldn't climb it. Every human attempt to create the world we want, including the Christian religion, churchianity, will fail. But the promise of the Bible, the promise is that God will do it for us. And if the Christian faith is different at all, it's because it's God himself coming to us rather than us trying to get to him. It's God himself making us fit for the world we all want, rather than any of us trying to make the world we all want. Do you see the difference? Now, as you do this course, you must decide whether that is what the Bible commends itself to you. Nobody else can prove that to you or argue that except God himself speaking to you and saying that he can do what you and nobody else can do and make you fit for the world that we all want. How did he do that? Well, we've learned already, haven't we, that he sent his son, Jesus Christ, into this world, paying for our sins and giving us new life. But we're going to find out some more about that next week as we think about Christ and his cross. That is the genius of the Christian faith, yet also its mystery. So I hope we see you then.